Welcome back to the Angletopia podcast, where we explore everything related to British travel, history, and culture. This week, our guest is historian and author Sophie Shoreland, who has written a fascinating new book called The Lost Queen, The Surprising Life of Catherine of Braganza. We're also running a contest to give away a copy of this book, so the link is in the show notes. So this is the book. You can see it right here if you're watching it on YouTube. Catherine of Braganza may not be a name that is widely known as some of her royal counterparts, but her influence on British history is undeniable. And Sophie's new book tells the incredible story of this Portuguese queen who became the wife of Charles II and helped shape the political and cultural and social landscape of Restoration-era England. From her pivotal role in Anglo-Portuguese relations to her love of tea that sparked a national obsession, Catherine's life is full of surprises. So today, we're going to dive into Catherine's remarkable legacy, how she navigated a court filled with intrigue and scandal, and why her story has often been overlooked in history. It's a captivating chapter in British history that you don't want to miss. So welcome, Sophie.
Thank you so much for having me and for that lovely, comprehensive introduction.
All right. So let's start at the beginning. What inspired you to write about Catherine of Braganza, a historical figure who has been largely overlooked?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, I hadn't really heard of her until I went to the National Portrait Gallery here in London. And I found this one queen kind of surrounded by other women. And I knew that lots of kings had had mistresses and, you know, that there had been influential women who weren't queens throughout history. So I wondered why this woman was kind of singled out as one among many for Charles II. And then I think I read her Wikipedia page because I was interested, and it said something like she failed as a queen because she was barren, which just seemed such a kind of, seemed a bit cruel, really.
That's so mean, yeah.
Wikipedia page, yeah, which is, they're usually supposed to be impartial. So that kind of got me interested because obviously she was still a queen in a time when, you know, if you compare the level of power available to even the weakest queen in the 17th century, it's still unfathomable compared to monarchs now. And, you know, I don't think anyone would call Elizabeth II a failure because she had comparatively less power. So yeah, I felt like she must have been a bit hard done by.
Where all good research starts, Wikipedia, right? So let's please give an overview of Catherine of Braganza, give a bit of background of who she was and kind of explain the context to people who haven't heard of her.
Yeah, so she was born in a really interesting time. So she was Portuguese. She was born in 1638 at a time in history that a lot of people outside Portugal don't really know about, because it was when the Iberian Peninsula was under one rule. Portugal wasn't independent. It was had been taken over by Spain. This kind of, at the time when she was born, the Portuguese were beginning to not be very happy about being ruled by Spain. It hadn't proved great for them economically. Socially, they were kind of becoming a Spanish province. So her father, João, was pretty much the only possible heir to the throne of Portugal. But he was much more interested in music and hunting than being king. Whereas Catherine's mother, Luisa, was very, very keen on the idea of being powerful and ruling a country. So Catherine's first sort of brush with international politics was when she was two, and her mother brought her into the room as a kind of emotional blackmail, saying to João something like, would you deny your daughter future opportunities by not taking the throne? And I don't know that this actually convinced him, but anyway, eventually there was a coup. They ousted the Spanish and then found themselves fighting a war for independence, which was obviously incredibly costly and difficult in terms of just finding troops as well, because Portugal, even today, is not that big a country. So they were looking for alliances, they were looking for troops, and this is where the idea of marriage to Charles II came in, and how Catherine ended up Queen of England as part of that negotiation.
Fascinating. So can you set the context, too, of Restoration-era England? This is right after the interregnum. You know, England had decapitated its king. We had a pseudo republic for what, almost 10 years. Then, so what happened then?
Yes. So then it's all a bit of a surprise, really, because Charles is still, I can't think of a better word than farting around the continent, trying to whip up money and support while the interregnum government is still kind of going on. Eventually, General Monk up in Scotland decides he's had enough, things are going badly. He comes down with all his troops to London and says, "We're having a king again, I've decided," and sends a missive over to Charles on the continent being like, you're back. So Charles really is such a surprise for the whole court. They didn't have very much to do with it. He gets reinstated. Part of the policy is to kind of heal the country after this incredibly difficult, contentious period where, you know, brother's been fighting brother, different sides of the civil war. Charles is fairly merciful towards most people, parliamentarians who fought against him, unless they were involved in actually signing the warrant to kill his father. And then he gets rid of them, basically, or sends assassins after them.
One of the biggest manhunts in history, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and his sister was very involved in it as well, which is an amazing chapter, but, you know, not relevant for Catherine's story, but another interesting woman. Anyway, so, and part of this trying to kind of repair the country after such a difficult period is this real focus on manners that you get with the Restoration. So people become very, very careful around each other. Maybe you don't delve too deeply into the political side they're on, and instead you're very careful with your pleases and your thank yous, which some people argue is why British people today are so obsessed with saying please and thank you, which is true, we are.
I love it. So Catherine's marriage to Charles II came with significant political implications, such as Bombay and India becoming a British territory. How do you think this marriage shaped Britain's imperial future? Because, you know, Portugal had this big empire, and Britain's empire at this stage is still pretty tiny. So, like, how did this influence that?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, and it's almost quite difficult to say what would have happened without this marriage, because you're in the realms of alternate history. So Portugal discovered the sea route to India. They navigated the vast sea of darkness, as it was called, because it was such an unknown, and they were the first to do it. So they were the first to sort of find that way through to India. Partly they were there actually to find lost Christians. So when they found people worshipping Krishna, they got really excited. They got a bit confused. But anyway, that was worked out by Catherine's time, that actually Krishna and Christ weren't the same person. So Catherine's marriage brought Bombay, which is now Mumbai, into British hands, which at the time it was seen as this actually a kind of pestilential swamp, I think it was described as. So it wasn't seen as this huge territory that would change things very much. But the British kind of developed it into, I think, still one of the biggest ports in the world. And yeah, without Catherine's marriage, would they have gained such a foothold in India so quickly? It's really difficult to say, but possibly not, and possibly more of the country might have been Portuguese or even French or Russian.
Fascinating. So one of the things I'm very excited to talk about, because I'm drinking my tea as we're doing this interview, is...
Oh, I've got to make one. I'm so annoyed.
How would you describe Catherine's role as a cultural influencer, particularly in bringing tea drinking to the UK? What's the story behind that?
I love that what you've used the word influencer, because it's sort of like she's this kind of social media influencer before her time, which is quite fun. So, yes, I mean... And actually, that's maybe a good analogy, because as a queen, she's all eyes are on her. And kind of, you know, when she ate dinner, people would literally gather behind railings to kind of peer at her and see what she was doing. So her kind of manners and tastes were incredibly influential. And when she got off the boat from Portugal in 1662 to marry Charles, she'd had a terrible journey. She'd been horribly seasick. It was grim. The boat really stank. So she got off the boat and she instantly asked for a cup of tea, which the British were then just very confused by.
What's that?
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine.
Yeah, this like really strong medicine that some really rich people have. And so anyway, they couldn't find any tea and she had to make do with beer, which she can't have been very impressed with. But she started to introduce tea drinking to the aristocracy. And it's kind of, you know, where the elite goes, the rest will probably eventually follow. It wasn't just her who popularized it, but she certainly did make quite a big difference. And it's kind of interesting as well, because at the time, coffee was drunk much more in England, but mostly in all male spaces of the coffee house. So this was a drink that's popularized by a woman, so you can have it at home, and it was women who really spearheaded the consumption of tea.
So where did the Portuguese get their tea from? Was it from that colony in India that Britain just got its hands on?
They got it initially from China.
Okay.
Same as India. So that's why in India it's still called chai often, because that's from Chinese, I believe, chow is the word. But I believe at the time only the Dutch could buy from China. So tea could also be grown in India. So they were beginning to have tea plantations in India as well, but initially from China. And the whole culture of tea drinking being poured into lovely cups was from China.
Ceremonial aspect of it, which I'm sure instantly appealed to the English as they're trying to introduce ceremony and politeness back after the rough time of the interregnum and all the dirty Republican years, you know, of Cromwell. And, you know, drinking tea is enjoyable, whereas Cromwell was famously anti-joy.
Yeah, and anti-Christmas and such things. Although opera flourished under his rule, so it's a funny one.
That is weird. So you in your book, you mentioned Catherine's interest in Baroque art and fashion and music. Can you talk about her impact on the arts in England during her reign? Because I know that this era of British arts was flourishing after the kind of the staid, boring Republican era.
Yeah, and even earlier, kind of England had always, for a long time, even under Elizabeth I, had been a bit of a cultural backwater, because she had favoured really flat portraits that were kind of iconographic. But yes, Catherine, she came from an incredibly musical, cultural family. Her father, we think, may have written the tune of O Come All Ye Faithful, among other kind of impressive musical compositions. So she had this background, and she came to England with a group of Portuguese musicians who were singing this kind of weird new tonality called the Baroque. And at the time, diarists like John Evelyn or Samuel Pepys record, but kind of, I think Evelyn said something like, they sing very ill, like these strange voices. They're not at all convinced by this new music. But after a few years, they're beginning to appreciate the Baroque. It's less shocking and alien to them. And it becomes really, really influential. And Catherine's chapel at Somerset House becomes one of the best places to go and hear music. So, and this is kind of like a deliberate strategy on her part, because not only is she really into music, but also she wants to kind of quietly convert as many souls as she can to Catholicism, because she's a very pious Catholic. So if she kind of hooks people in with the music, they might be tempted to see the benefits of Catholicism and maybe come to her chapel to worship as well. And then she was also one of the first patrons in England of Baroque art as well. So when she first came to England, Lely was the kind of court painter, and he's known for painting women kind of very loosely robed, very heavy lidded eyes. They look like they've just kind of rolled out of bed. And Catherine wasn't particularly impressed with this way of presenting herself. She wanted to kind of say different things in her portraits. So she fairly quickly found a new up-and-coming Dutch painter called Jacob Huysmans, who would become her favorite painter. And he did things like painted her with different angels to kind of signify that she's a queen and has the divine right of queens, and also painted her as her namesake, St. Catherine of Alexandria, so with the Catherine wheel and the quill denoting both of their learning. And this portrait in particular kind of started a fad of women being painted as Catherine of Alexandria.
Interesting. Is the portrait on the book, is that one of his, or is it a different one?
That's one of, it's a different portrait to the English copy. So I think that is the Lily of her, actually, I think, because it's got the heavy lidded eyes.
It's a very interesting portrait, I think. Yeah. You mentioned Catholicism. So let's pull that thread a little bit, because this is, you know,
big thread.
Yeah. I mean, the Reformation is still happening. We've gone through the very Protestant interregnum years. What is, you know, like you said, Catholicism is not something that you should be publicly, you know, professing right now. So how did she adjust in that world?
In some ways, not very well, because I would say she was fairly unrealistic about returning England to Catholicism. She was a real believer in the divine right of kings, and so sort of thought that you could just push stuff through without necessarily consulting the population. So she really tried to push to have English cardinals and to have a relationship with Rome. But luckily for her, she was never as interested in English politics as she was in Portuguese politics. So she tended not to push too hard for kind of English Catholicism, which saved her a bit from kind of accusations that her mother-in-law, Henrietta Maria, had kind of been through with meddling and petticoat government and things like that. And also helping her was the fact that Catherine was genuinely very pious, which ironically the Puritans actually really respected, because it kind of goes full circle in a funny sort of way. You know, she was so devotedly pious, they kind of in a way respected her conviction. And she also kind of deliberately positioned herself in contrast to her husband's mistresses as having a kind of very simple faith. So she decorated her bedroom with very simple devotional images and not too much ostentation. And of course, at the time, bedrooms weren't really private spaces. This was a public space with people going through it all the time. So this was a kind of deliberate projection that, you know, Catholicism wasn't necessarily this big, ostentatious, scary affair.
Speaking of Charles II's mistresses, let's talk about that. So, you know, he's well known as the man of many mistresses, many bastard children, who, you know, the current British aristocracy loves to claim descent from one of them at one point or another. So Catherine's personal life was marked by many challenges, including her childlessness and her husband's numerous affairs. So how do you think she navigated this and still maintained her influence and dignity with all this going on with this notorious husband of hers?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually on that point of the aristocracy, I think William will be the first king to be descended from Charles II, because his mother was a descendant of one of the illegitimate children. So
That's great. That's fascinating. That's going to be one of the social media clips for this episode.
So yeah, I think we'll have a Stuart on the throne again. So maybe some Jacobites will be quietly rejoicing. But yeah, I think it was, especially at the beginning of her reign, I think the way Charles flaunted his mistresses was really, really difficult. So we have to kind of understand that Catherine came from a really different culture. Portugal was in some ways much more formal. It wasn't acceptable to have mistresses who were in the aristocracy. You could sleep with a servant, that was fine, but they're kind of tucked away and they're not really anything to do with your social life. So she comes to England. She already knows that her husband has at least one mistress and has been warned by her mother never to have anything to do with this, you know, common hussy.
I love it.
So she tries her best not to have anything to do with Charles's mistresses, but Charles insists on his principal mistress, Barbara Palmer, Countess Castlemaine. He insists that Castlemaine be one of Catherine's ladies of the bedchamber, which is a really kind of intimate role that involves dressing her and kind of getting her ready for the day and just being a constant companion. Catherine, which, yeah, it's pretty horrible.
Yeah, I mean, that's just mean.
Yeah, it's mean. It's so mean. It's so not tactful. And it's actually not like much like Charles's personality otherwise. He's actually generally relatively tactful. But in this case, absolutely not. Anyway, when she first gets to England, they have all these screaming matches about it. At one point, she faints and has a nosebleed because of all the emotional stress it's causing her. Basically, Charles eventually calls her bluff and says, you know, fine, if you really don't want me to have a mistress, then go back to Portugal, see if I care. And Catherine knows that English troops and English money are really important for winning the war against Spain that Portugal is fighting. So she basically has to choose whether she's going to be humiliated by having this mistress as her constant companion or go back and potentially Portugal will lose the war for independence. So she chooses to stay, and later she kind of talks about sacrificing herself for Portugal. And she also realizes that Charles is never going to be swayed on this matter, and if she wants to have any kind of influence in the English court, she's going to need to at least pretend to be okay with the situation. So she publicly makes up with Castlemaine, they drive out together, and she does her best to remain very tactful around the mistresses. And Charles is very appreciative of this. And in times of later difficulty, he kind of says, you know, she's been so understanding about me, I have to stick by her. So it does pay dividends in the end. And also, interestingly as well, the mistresses become a kind of focus of popular discontent because they're seen as wasting public money, being a kind of site of immorality. So in some ways, it makes Catherine more popular because she's this abused wife in the public imagination. And she really plays into that narrative as well by kind of casting herself in this role of obedient wife. So that also gets her out of a couple of scrapes through her reign as well.
Interesting, the public victim.
Yeah, it's very effective.
Yeah, it's a strategy still very effective in public scandals to this day.
Yeah. And it's a kind of like a PR coup, I suppose, is how you'd put it today. Yeah.
My wife would love that. She works in PR, so.
Perfect, yeah.
So what are, as you were researching this book, what were some of the most surprising discoveries you made while researching her?
Gosh, there were loads, actually, because, I mean, we talked at the beginning about how I just had looked on Wikipedia. So obviously, there were loads of things that I found really surprising. I think one of the more surprising ones, strangely, is that Queens in New York was named after her. Yeah, so I knew that Kings, or now Brooklyn, was named after Charles II, and New York was named after his brother, James II, back when he was Duke of York. I'd never heard about Queens. And that's partly because it's sort of weirdly contested. So we know it was named Queens during Catherine's reign and during a time when things were named after her. So there are a couple of streets in London, for example, that were named Queen Street after her. But because it was never written down, people have sort of contested that it might not have been named after Catherine. But it would have been really strange of the British to have named a county Queens after, you know, like Louis XIV's queen?
Right, or somebody else, yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely Catherine. So I found that like a very interesting one because I'm not quite sure why it's a site of contention, I suppose.
People just like to argue.
Yeah. Fair enough. I mean, that's how historians make their money, I suppose, having a good argument and like, oh, everyone who's gone before me had history totally wrong, so fair enough. So yeah, that was a really interesting one. And I think another one maybe as well was that she's got this reputation for being kind of this boring, obedient wife. So I didn't really expect her to have popularized wearing trousers or pants, which was a kind of very risque fashion. And she popularized partly through sheer vanity because she had really great ankles and wanted to show them off. But also it was a bit of like a, woohoo, we're wearing the trousers political statement as well. And she dressed all of her ladies in trousers and they kind of ceremonially dashed around the parks, kind of looking very
scandalous.
Scandalous, exactly.
Our Amish listeners are just gonna go crazy.
How do you know how many Amish listeners you have? Is that part of your stats?
They live about an hour from here, so you never know. You never know. They might love British history and culture as much as I do.
And listen to podcasts.
Exactly. Famously. Well, they some of them use cell phones these days, so you never know.
Yeah.
So I hope I didn't offend any of our Amish listeners. So any other interesting tidbits that you also found while doing your research?
Yeah, I mean, I think other tidbits that I found were sort of how she was almost always this figure that most histories haven't talked about, but she's kind of there at every great event. So kind of when England is going to war against the Dutch, she's there kind of inspecting the ships and advocating for war, partly because the Dutch had been at war with Portugal, so, you know, she was fairly biased. And when plans to rebuild London after the Great Fire were being discussed, she was there kind of looking over plans. When kind of, I believe, sorry, let me just check my notes because I didn't want to say this wrong. Halley's Comet, yeah. When Halley's Comet was seen going over London and Isaac Newton was kind of making his calculations based on that comet, she was there kind of witnessing it as well.
And live math.
Yeah, it's really amazing looking at his journals, actually, which I did a little bit. Unfortunately, didn't manage to put much in the book because it's not very relevant. I would have liked to kind of segue more into Newton, but it didn't really work. But yeah, as he's, it's kind of at the beginning of his career and he's really trying to work things out. And so, yeah, she's this figure, is kind of involved in every great event of the second half of the 17th century. And yet you just never hear about. So yeah, I was really surprised to kind of find her in all these places that I just hadn't expected.
It makes you wonder who else in history we've kind of forgotten about who was at all of the major events like that. Mm. So this may seem boring to other people, but I'm always really interested in process. So like, what was your research process? Did you visit archives? Did you interlibrary loan some really old books? How did that go?
Well, it was quite difficult, parts of it, because parts of it was in COVID. So I was kind of contacting like Portuguese libraries, like, please, could you take a picture of this for me? or like, do you have this digitized? Because I couldn't really get to Portugal. And also I didn't speak Portuguese. So that was a difficult challenge. And then it was, yeah, a lot of, luckily we have lots of her letters in the British Library. And I also found this amazing cache of letters from John Methuen, who was the Portuguese ambassador, which hadn't really been mined before. So that was very exciting as a discovery. And he was writing very extensively about her time in Portugal. So after Charles II died, she went back to Portugal and became queen there. And he gives loads of detail about her, what she was doing and kind of taking ass's milk baths and all this kind of private information that you wouldn't find anywhere else. So that was quite amazing. And then, yeah, I unpicked quite a few fallacies, I suppose, because a lot of history gets repeated without necessarily double checking. And I'm sure I'm guilty of that as well. So there were a few kind of aspects of her life that I couldn't find evidence for, which was a shame and had to kind of leave out of the book. But yeah, it was a real sifting through a lot of manuscripts, and obviously also her correspondence with heads of state like Louis XIV was quite amazing to kind of like touch in person as well. So when you're touching Louis XIV's letters, that was very exciting.
It does sound exciting. I'm a little jealous.
Yeah, come to British Library.
All right. I have been there. I went there for an exhibition once, and I like, I was just in awe of the place with the whole central stacks behind the glass, and like, it was it was most impressive.
It's amazing.
I need to get a book deal that will allow me to go do research at the British Library.
You definitely do. Yeah. It's been hacked now though, so it's
yeah. Are they still having issues with that? Is it still hard to get in and out of there?
It's not so bad now, but it's still not back to what it was.
Wild. I work, my day job is in IT and internet marketing, and it's just wild that that's been going on for so long.
Yeah, but every year now. Yeah.
So your book touches on Catherine's role as a diplomat. Can you elaborate a little more on how she used her position to maintain ties with Portugal and other European powers? Like you mentioned, the letters to other European heads of state.
Yeah, so at the time, a really important aspect of being queen was seen as being a diplomat to other powers. And this was at where actually Catherine's Catholicism came in quite handy, because she was kind of corresponding with the Pope and with Louis XIV, who as he aged, became a lot more Catholic and conservative. So she was very important in kind of maintaining ties with these powers. She also, some of her staff were also used to negotiate the secret treaty, which was basically Charles II negotiated a treaty with Louis XIV, where he would be paid a vast sum of money and in exchange would convert Catholicism and try and encourage England to become Catholic as well. So, which was why it's called the secret treaty, because it was so inflammatory, it could never sort of see the light of day. And there is a possibility that Catherine was involved in that, but we don't really know for sure. And then she was constantly really, really interested in what was going on in Portugal and helped to smooth over kind of scandals that happened in Portugal as well, and kind of maintain diplomatic relations with England. So, for example, her younger brother, Pedro, this is some very complicated family politics, but basically her younger brother, Pedro, had an affair with his elder brother, King Afonso's wife. I don't know if that's followable.
It is. Yeah, I follow it. Okay.
Yeah, getting the connection.
Yeah.
And then Pedro and the wife decided to depose Afonso. So Afonso is no longer king, and Pedro and Maria Francisca get together, become king and queen. But awkwardly, Afonso's still alive and is just consigned to prison. In England, it's a really kind of debated subject whether they should cut off diplomatic relations with Portugal for this incident, because obviously Charles II is thinking, like, I have a younger brother, maybe I shouldn't be encouraging this kind of thing. But anyway, Catherine kind of supporting Pedro helped to maintain that alliance. And I think it helped that she and her brother Pedro had always been their mother's favorite children. So poor Afonso had a bit of a terrible time of it, really. And there's a palace in Sintra, just outside of Lisbon, where allegedly you can see the markings on the floor from where he was imprisoned and just paced up and down.
Huh, interesting. I'd be imprisoned in a palace.
Yeah.
So Catherine's dowry not only included land, but also significant wealth. How did this financial contribution influence Charles II's reign and England's economy at the time? Was it a big influx of cash for Charles?
It was a big influx of cash, although, they were promised an astronomical dowry of 2 million cruzados, which I think is approximately $62 million today. Yeah, quite a lot. And this, because Charles, as is quite understandable, always had a bit of a fractious relationship with Parliament. He never wanted to call Parliament. So wherever possible, he tried to find money elsewhere. So this was a huge inducement for him to marry Catherine. But when it actually came to paying the dowry, obviously Portugal at the time was at war. They were really stretched. So Louisa, Catherine's mother, loaded lots of kind of sugar and bills of exchange onto the ship with Catherine, rather than actual money, which the English were a bit miffed at. And I think they had kind of expected this money to be life-changing. and to kind of pay off all the cavaliers who had lost land and money in the Civil War. But obviously, you know, this much money, when you try and split it kind of 500 ways, doesn't actually go that far when you're kind of trying to split it between a nation. So it definitely had an impact, but I would say more in making Catherine popular in the early years of her reign rather than necessarily changing England that much.
Your book touches on the broader political landscape of Catherine's time, including her role in Portugal's independence. Could you talk more about her importance in this period of English-Portuguese relations? Because a lot of people don't realize that Portugal and Britain actually have a really close-knit history. Like, there's still English families in Portugal who are wine merchants who have been there for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah, which is quite amazing. And it's partly down to Catherine, actually. So the Anglo-Portuguese or Anglo-Lusitanian alliance does predate Catherine and goes back to the marriage of one of John O'Gaunt's daughters, Philippa, which is quite amazing. But when Catherine, after Charles died and when Catherine went back to Portugal, they were kind of flirting with the French and were kind of making an alliance with the French. So Catherine kind of helped put a stop to this alliance and brought them back into the Anglosphere, for better or worse, because lots of Portuguese historians think that was a terrible thing. They believe it stifled Portuguese industry because they bought British goods instead. But anyway, she did sign the treaty that kind of is still the longest alliance England has with any country. And it did things like make port wine a lot cheaper to import. So that kind of 18th century obsession with port is in large part thanks to Catherine and all those wine merchants still living in Portugal. And Porto can, in some sense, be ascribed to Catherine, which is quite fun. And also, yeah, it was very important for World War II as well, the alliance. So Portugal kind of secretly sided with Britain and allowed military to be stationed on the Azores and things like that.
Spies and whatnot. Yeah. While Spain skulked in neutrality, right?
Yeah, and the idea was that Portugal was secretly on Britain's side because if they declared, then Spain might declare.
So back to Charles II, Catherine is often remembered for her devotion and loyalty to him despite all his infidelities. How do you think their personal dynamic shaped her public and private life?
So I think that she quickly, kind of as I said, learned to be very tactful with Charles, and he, in the end, did really appreciate that. So in her kind of greatest period of crisis, the 1670s, when it was clear that she wasn't going to be able to have a child, and there were lots of calls for Charles to divorce her and marry a, you know, blooming young Protestant, Charles really kind of stuck by her. And also during the Popish plot in 1678, which was when a great period of persecution for Catholics, when basically one man, Titus Oates, just denounced everyone and was believed. And there was a bit of like a McCarthy-esque witch hunt. Charles refused to believe that Catherine would ever contemplate harming him or would ever be involved in any plot against him. And he very publicly kind of drove out with her and was seen dining with her. And one commentator said the wife has now become a mistress during this time period. So I think her earlier tact and willingness to kind of work with Charles meant that in the end, they did have a very supportive relationship. And he did really appreciate that, because if there was one thing in the world Charles didn't like, it was being told what to do. And I think Catherine realized that she couldn't do that, so had to kind of work with him in other ways to get what she wanted.
Super interesting. I always love hearing about these great marriages and how they made things work, and it's fascinating stuff. So for my last question, what is one lesson from Catherine's life that you came across when you did your research that really stuck with you since finishing the book?
Yeah, I think something that really struck me about Catherine's life. So it wasn't always particularly easy. She was also kind of subject to fits of depression throughout her life. She had quite a lot of illnesses, but she had one very clear goal throughout her life, and that was whatever was good for Portugal. And she really stuck to that and was incredibly devoted to that cause. And I think, you know, that's something that stuck with me, as however difficult she could be, you know, she wasn't always the easiest person, but she was passionate about this aim. And I think that, for better or worse, is a very admirable trait.
Steady. And I think it's interesting that when Charles II died, she went back to Portugal and became queen there. So she was rewarded for her loyalty.
Yeah, and she's really well known in Portugal. So she's forgotten in the Anglosphere, but the Portuguese have not forgotten her. So you see her statue everywhere in Portugal. And yeah, and there's like a Portuguese shop down my road, and as soon as I was like, Catherine of Braganza, it's like, oh yes, she's amazing tea.
Should have a book signing there, right?
Yeah.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for joining us on the Angletopia podcast, Sophie. The book is called The Lost Queen, The Surprising Life of Catherine of Braganza, and it's available from booksellers everywhere, and it just came out in the USA. We will put a link in the show notes. We are also giving away a copy, and so we'll put a link to the entry form for that as well, so be sure to enter. And if you enjoyed the Angletopia podcast, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a comment, hit the like button. So we'll see you next time. Thank you.